Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A surprising report. A sharp drop in the number of new jobs raises questions about the economy and concerns about the labor force. Then, hate on the rise. Multiple recent attacks against Asian Americans highlight the threats of violence and prejudice faced by the community. Plus, one-on-one, we discuss the ongoing pandemic response and economic recovery with Senator Elizabeth Warren. And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart consider the shakeup in Republican leadership and the Biden approach to the economy. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. April's U.S. jobs report fell far short of what many analysts expected. The Labor Department today reported that employers added just 266,000 jobs last month, while the unemployment rate rose slightly to 6.1%. At the White House, President Biden urged patience as the latest COVID stimulus package is implemented.
It was designed to help us over the course of a year, not 60 days, a year. We never thought that after the first 50 or 60 days, everything would be fine. Today, there's more evidence that our economy is moving in the right direction. But it's clear we have a long way to go.
We'll take a closer look at the jobs report after the news summary. India broke another grim record today with more than 414,000 new COVID infections in the last 24 hours. School buses are being converted into mobile oxygen sites as hospitals scramble to find space for the surge of COVID patients. A representative of the United Nations Humanitarian Agency in Geneva voiced concern about the escalating crisis.
The wave is almost four times the size of the first wave, and the virus is spreading much faster. On an average, there were more than four new cases every second and more than two deaths every minute in the last 24 hours. What is happening in India should raise alarm bells for all of us. The pandemic is far from over.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization granted emergency authorization to China's Sinopharm COVID vaccine. It is 78% effective among those younger than 60. Pfizer has started the application process for a full Food and Drug Administration approval of its COVID vaccine for people 16 and older. It is the first vaccine manufacturer to do so. Meanwhile, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are looking into whether the official global COVID death toll needs to be revised higher. Its director weighed in on a University of Washington report that estimates there were more than 900,000 U.S. deaths. That is far higher than the current toll.
Just those who've passed from COVID-19 specifically, but excess deaths relating to access to care, not presenting to care, and many other things. So we will look at this carefully, and then we will work with within the CDC to make decisions as to whether to count them as excess or to count them as COVID-specific.
The current official U.S. COVID death toll is roughly 581,000. Vice President Kamala Harris appealed for cooperation with Mexico today to curb the rise in migrants arriving at the U.S. southern border. She held a virtual meeting with President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador. Harris has been leading the diplomatic efforts to address the challenges in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador that are driving migration.
Together, we must fight violence. We must fight corruption and impunity. It is in our country's mutual interest to provide immediate relief to the Northern Triangle and to address the root causes of migration. You and I have discussed before an understanding and a belief most people don't want to leave home.
Harris plans to travel to Mexico and Guatemala next month for her first foreign trip as vice president. Meanwhile, in Donna, Texas, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas toured a processing facility that housed nearly 4,000 unaccompanied migrant children at the start of April. Today, he said that number is just above 300. A federal grand jury has indicted four former Minneapolis police officers involved in the death of George Floyd with violating his civil rights. The three-count indictment says that Derek Chauvin and the other officers failed to provide Floyd with medical care, among other charges. Last month, Chauvin was convicted of murder and manslaughter. Texas is now the latest Republican-led state to advance a restrictive election overhaul. The bill would limit mail-in ballots and empower partisan poll watchers, among other things. It passed the state House after an all-night debate, but it still needs to be reconciled with the state Senate before it's sent to the governor's desk. In Jerusalem, clashes erupted tonight between Palestinian worshipers and Israeli police at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. More than 50 people were injured. Violence escalated over the potential eviction of Palestinians from land claimed by Jewish settlers. Protesters threw rocks at Israeli police, who fired back with stun grenades and tear gas. Emergency crews rushed the wounded away. And on Wall Street today, stocks rallied in spite of last month's hiring slowdown. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 229 points to close at a record 34,778. The Nasdaq rose 119 points, and the S&P 500 added 31 to hit another record high. Still to come on the NewsHour, attacks against Asian Americans highlight the prejudice faced by that community. We discussed the president's economic agenda with Senator Elizabeth Warren. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down the week's political news and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
With millions of people still out of work, today's jobs report was a puzzle to many analysts who had expected hundreds of thousands more new jobs to have been created. As we heard, President Biden picked up on this today to try to make his case for large federal spending on the economy, infrastructure, and addressing inequality. His plans could add $4 trillion more dollars in spending, but it is the subject of considerable debate. Lisa Desjardins looks at all of that.
Judy, as more Americans get vaccinated, there's been much speculation that the economy could roar back this year. Today's report wasn't bad by any means, but it didn't suggest that kind of recovery was in the offing yet. In fact, it left many with questions about what it means and about economic prescriptions being debated right now. For that, we turn to Ellen Hughes Cromwick, a former chief economist at the Commerce Department during the Obama administration. She's now at Third Way, a center-left think tank. And Michael Strain is an economist with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. You know, these were some surprising and disappointing numbers, and also, I have to say, a bit confusing. Unemployment is still high, but yet I see some businesses say that they just can't find workers. Ellen, I want to start with you. What do you think these numbers are telling us?
Thank you for having me. It really is a snapshot from last month. And as we know, looking across the country, there are very different ways in which states are opening up. And therefore, the restrictions still from the COVID crisis are really impacting businesses. But just to be clear, it's one snapshot. We actually lost 22 million jobs during the COVID crisis as it emerged last year. And we've gained back a substantial amount of those jobs. We're still losing about 8 million as compared to our pre-COVID job level. A lot of, you know, hopefully good recovery ahead. But we're still in the middle of this. And I think maybe expectations ran a little bit over the edge of the skis when people thought about a million new jobs in April.
Michael, what did you get from this snapshot, as Ellen calls it?
Well, I'd like to just echo one point Ellen made. I think it's important not to read too much into any one month's data. And there's a risk of doing that, given how disappointing the data were for the month of April. You know, to my mind, the basic story of the labor market is still the same. We have a jobs gap of about 11 million, We have a workforce participation rate that hasn't really improved since June. And so, you know, talk of the jobs market being hot, I think is just premature. The demand side of the labor market is in better shape than the supply side. And that could cause issues with wages spiking. It could cause issues with what's being deemed in the press as worker shortages. But the important thing to do, I think, is to keep our eye on the ball. And the ball is that 11 million jobs hole in the labor market. Supply issues are going to resolve themselves as daycare centers reopen, as schools reopen, as the extra generous unemployment benefits expire in September. I would expect supply to come back. And I think the story for 2021 is still going to be a pretty rapid recovery.
You know, this seems to me one of those times where policymakers have to make decisions before they have all the information, because as both of you are saying, we're still in the middle of this. And this isn't just academic. You know, Montana and South Carolina are both ending those added unemployment benefits early, because what you're talking about, Michael, they believe there's a real supply issue with labor, that those unemployment benefits are helping keep people home. The two of you had differing opinions on this on Twitter. And I want to start with you, Michael. Do you believe, or why do you believe, that those added unemployment benefits are in fact keeping people home?
Well, I do believe that. I think that if you look at the kind of totality of the evidence on this question, the conclusions are that the more generous unemployment benefits are, the longer workers stay unemployed. That didn't happen in the spring and summer of 2020. But of course, that was a pretty unusual period when lockdowns were very severe. If you look at the half century before the pandemic, what you would take away from the body of evidence is that more generous unemployment benefits keep workers unemployed for longer. With the $300 supplement that's currently in place until September, about half of workers have a higher income from unemployment benefits than they would have from working. And I think it's just common sense that with unemployment benefits that are that generous, workers are going to take longer to search for a job than they otherwise would.
Ellen, what do you think is keeping people home? Is Michael right about this?
I really disagree with that assessment of unemployment insurance. And let me give you one example that I think is very clear. In the data today, we learned that the leisure and hospitality sector grew jobs by over 300,000. And in fact, if you look at just hotel and restaurant jobs, they rose by over 200,000 in 1 month. In fact, those jobs have grown by 60% since the depth of the COVID job loss in April of last year. In other words, it's grown six times more or faster than the average job gain. So that suggests to me, for those workers, the average wage is $17 an hour. They're getting back to work as fast as they can. That is safe to get back to work. So the people that would benefit from unemployment insurance benefits, they're coming back to the workforce. And that's why we see restaurant and hotel workers going back, if they can. That is, if they can get, you know, daycare and their kids are back in school, which was one of the other key items in the report, was that that actually women lost jobs last month. So you have to sit back and say, why are these women not coming back? Why aren't they getting jobs? Well, they've got challenges when it comes to daycare and school.
And briefly, just with our last minute left, I want to ask both of you, what do you think this moment means for the debate over the idea that President Biden is putting forth, that government should go big? Ellen, first to you, should government go big now, and why, in just 30 seconds?
Absolutely. We need investment. We need investment in infrastructure, investment in people. We have underinvested for many years. Let's think about this opportunity right now to really make a difference. Go bold. Austerity doesn't work. Austerity means that we're going to shrink, not grow.
And Michael?
I think that there are good things that the president is proposing to spend money on. There are certain aspects of the infrastructure plan and the families plan that I think would invest in people, invest in the economy, and provide long-term benefits. I think the American Rescue Plan, the stimulus, was much, much too large. And if we do have a period of several months where demand is booming and supply can't keep up, which is what it looks like currently, then we're going to have the size of the president's stimulus plan partially to blame, and that's going to make it harder for him to do other big things.
A very robust debate that we hope we will keep up with you both on. Ellen Hughes Cromwick and Michael Strain, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is a growing and disturbing trend, a rise in hateful acts from slurs to physical violence against Asian Americans and people of Pacific Islander descent. Amna Nawaz reports.
Judy, there's been a series of brutal and public attacks against Asian Americans. Just last Sunday, two women, 65 and 85 years old, were stabbed while waiting at a bus stop in San Francisco. Also this week in the same city, a man was beaten on the street while pushing his toddler stroller. In New York this week, two women were attacked by a stranger with a hammer demanding they remove their masks. And here in Washington, D.C., a local store owner was punched in the face by a customer. The group Stop AAPI Hate this week released new numbers showing a substantial rise in hate incidents, more than 6,600 over a one-year period. Russell Jung is the co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate. He's also a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University, and he joins me now. Russell Jung, welcome to the NewsHour, and tell us, what can you share with us about these numbers? What kinds of incidents are we talking about? Who's being targeted and where?
Thank you, Amna. I'm glad to be here. Yeah, the numbers are alarming. The surge of racism against Asian Americans has continued from last year to this year. The crimes against Asian Americans, especially the assaults against the elderly, have been heinous. Vulnerable populations are targeted. Women get attacked twice as much as men. Youth and elderly are attacked more often. We also know this is a case of racial profiling, that Chinese make up 40% of our incident reports, but non-Chinese, those who look East Asian, are also being attacked, and they're racially profiling us and attacking us.
This may be an impossible question to answer, but do we know why? Do we know what's fueling these attacks right now?
Oh, yeah, I think it's pretty clear. Fear of the pandemic got exacerbated by the political rhetoric last year. The term China virus was deadly because it racialized the virus, and it made the virus Chinese, and it stigmatized Chinese people as being the disease carriers. The other factor, though, it's a separate trend, is the crimes that we're facing. Asian Americans, especially in low-income areas, have always experienced high victimhood to crimes because of the neighborhoods that they live in. And that in all urban areas, there's been a higher crime rate because of the economic conditions caused by the pandemic. So the two trends are both, being conflated as hate crimes.
So we know there has been some effort to try to address this increase at the federal level. We know President Biden has taken executive action at the legislative level. We know Congress has passed some related legislation. There's task forces, too, in major cities, right, to address this. But what else can be done to prevent the attacks from happening in the first place?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, the steps you've discussed are actually hate crimes enforcement, police task force. But again, we want to prevent the crimes before they actually occur, right? And so for us to address the racism, we have to have ethnic studies to teach people about different racial groups and to develop empathy. We want to expand civil rights protections so that people who get harassed in stores, for example, are protected. And we want to improve community conditions where, violent crime erupts, especially the economic conditions and the resources provided to those neighborhoods.
Russell, this week also saw the launch of TAAF, right? The Asian American Foundation. It's an unprecedented effort led by Sonal Shah with business leaders like Jerry Yang, the co-founder of Yahoo, Joe Tsai, the owner of the Brooklyn Nets. sports stars like Naomi Osaka and Jeremy Lin, they're putting $250 million into the community in an unprecedented way. Where does that money go, and what kind of difference does that kind of money make towards this effort?
Yeah, I think it's a great effort, a needed effort. And again, it's an Asian American initiated effort because the broader community, other foundations have neglected us. Foundations we know have given just a small percent of their dollars to the Asian American community, even though we, again, clearly have needs, clearly have low-income communities. So the Asian American community has had to take it on itself to fund itself. And then hopefully what the Asian American Foundation can do is multiply the dollars that they've seeded it with. They're donated money to Stop API Hate.
Russell, the numbers are certainly alarming, but the videos, and many of these attacks are caught on camera, are equally horrifying. And they do a great deal to spread more alarm and fear and deepen that fear within the community. I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit, because we're at a place where in some ways no place feels safe for Asian Americans. Have you seen that? Have you heard other people expressing that same sentiment?
Yeah, I just felt chills as you mentioned that, how traumatizing it is and how much it's creating a sense of fear and siege among the Asian American community. I know because we've been working with elderly and doing research with them, they're especially concerned and staying indoors for fear of their own safety. So this is a moment of crisis for the Asian American community. I can't underscore how it's created a sense of anxiety and distress. And for our youth, as they go back to schools, we're concerned for their that they may be bullied. So we really call on government now to really establish policies to address this racism in a comprehensive manner.
That is Russell Jiang, co-founder of the group Stop AAPI Hate, joining us tonight. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Amna.
During her 14-month campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren was known for her plans. While she didn't make it to the White House, she is now working with President Biden on infrastructure, education, and a number of other issues. She also has just released a new book of campaign stories and, yes, plans. It is titled Persist. And Senator Warren joins us now. It's very good to have you again on the NewsHour. Senator, I want to ask you to start off with about today's jobs report, because we are hearing from some critics who say the numbers were disappointing, that the country needs to give more of an incentive to people who aren't working by ending extended unemployment benefits.
The numbers are a reminder that we need universal child care in this country. We've already seen how women have had to drop out of the workforce, have been pushed out of the workforce, and one of the principal reasons is because of child care. You know, we had a child care crisis long before the pandemic came along, but with the pandemic, a bad problem got a whole lot worse. Now, the good news is that the rescue plan had child care in it, but we now need to make child care part of our basic infrastructure.
Are you saying that President Biden's proposal on child care is what you agree with?
He is in the right direction. The numbers are not high enough yet. He's proposed about $425 billion over 10 years. It's really going to take about $700 billion to give us universal child care. But he understands the problem. We just need to make sure that the solution is the same size as the problem. You know, and since we're here to talk about the book in part, I'll just make the note on this, Judy. This is where I start the book, is about how personal policy is. And for me, I started with being a mother, about how I had my first teaching job, got fired because I was pregnant. I'm at home, I decide to go back to school, and come within a hair's breadth of not being able to do that because I couldn't get child care. I tell the personal stories, but what really gets to me is that was 40 years ago. My daughter then faces the same problem. And if we don't make changes in this country, my granddaughter will face those same problems. It's time to treat childcare for what it is. It's basic infrastructure. We want people to go to work. We need universal childcare.
A number of things I want to ask you about, Senator, but let me just ask you overall, put your professor's hat on. What grade would you give President Biden for these first, 108 days?
Now, you know, Judy, that professors never give a grade until the end of the term. But do let me say, because I actually want to pass out some praise here. He helped us pass the most ambitious, the most progressive rescue package in American history. And he made a really important move during this that I'm not sure enough people have paid attention to. He said he wanted to be bipartisan. He invited the Republicans in to negotiate. When they said nope, they wanted no part of it. He talked to the American people, and he saw the support from Democrats, Republicans, and independents. He said that is bipartisan. And all of the Democrats in the Senate linked arms, and we passed it. We got it through. That's momentous.
And Senator, as I said, a number of things I want to ask you about. It doesn't sound like you're going to give him a grade, but let's talk about how he plans to pay for these ambitious plans. You were known for the tax proposals you had on the wealthiest Americans. Do his plans to tax the wealthy go far enough, in your opinion?
Not yet. He's in the right direction again because he's talking about taxing the wealthy. He's got a little bit around wealth. But let me just give you three ideas together, plans. If we put a wealth tax in place, 2-cent tax on fortunes above $50 million, a little bit more for billionaires, and a 7% tax on real corporate profits, flat across the board, for these companies making more than $100 million, this catches companies like Amazon and FedEx, Nike, that make millions in profits and pay nothing in taxes. And if we step up enforcement of current tax laws, those three changes, we would bring in $6 trillion over the next 10 years. That would be enough to pay for all of President Biden's infrastructure plans, all of his family caregiving plans, and still have a couple of trillion dollars left over. So we can do this. We just need to be willing to step up and get it done.
Noteworthy, you say that there's a new study out by the Penn Wharton School saying that something like 90% of the president's taxes on investments could be avoided by people who are at that level. But I want to also ask you, Senator, about student loan forgiveness. I know you and Senator Schumer and others are urging President Biden to go along with a plan to forgive up to $50,000 in student loan debt. But there's a study by the Brookings Institution that says those in the lowest income quintile, the poorest, would get an average of only about $570 in student debt forgiveness, while those in the very highest quintile would get four times that much, at least.
So,
is there a problem?
So let me start by pointing out that what we're talking about is only canceling $50,000 of student loan debt, not 100% of student loan debt. The debts of the plastic surgeons and the fancy lawyers, that's not covered here. But in that $50,000, let's make clear, 40% of those who are carrying student loan debt have no college diploma. In other words, they're struggling to pay off student loan debt. Why? Because they tried. They tried, but then had a baby, couldn't manage three jobs and going to school, somebody got sick, transportation broke down. And they are now dealing with student loan debt on what you make as a high school graduate. Also, we have a huge black-white wealth gap problem in this country. And the problem is exacerbated by student loan debt. African Americans have to borrow more money to go to school, more money to stay in school, and have a harder time paying it off. Just one stat on this, the typical white borrower, 20 years after they've borrowed student loan debt, they owe 5% of their original amount that they borrowed. The end is in sight. The typical black borrower owes 95%. By canceling student loan debt, we can shrink the black-white wealth gap for people with student loan debt by 25 points. This is the single biggest thing that President Biden could do all by himself to help bring some equity and racial equality economically to this country.
And in a word, do you think he'll go along with it?
I sure hope so.
We will leave it there, Senator Elizabeth Warren. The title of her new book is Persist. Senator, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
To reflect a little on what Senator Warren had to say and more on the events of this week, it's time for Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. It is so good to see both of you smiling faces on this Friday evening. And I do want to get to Senator Warren, David, but first let me ask you about today's jobs numbers. They were disappointing. It was expected there would be many hundreds of thousands more than there were. Did these numbers say something about, frankly, the wisdom of President Biden's economic plans?
Maybe. I don't think we know yet. But, you know, we're doing two gigantic experiments that are really unprecedented in American history. We've never spent $6 trillion in such a short period of time and gone into debt while doing it. If the two other Biden plan passes, it'll be $10 trillion. At the same time, we've never seen Fed expansionary policy this momentous. And so this is an experiment, and maybe it'll pay off. But maybe there'll be inflation. Warren Buffett's a little worried about inflation. Other people are worried about inflation. Maybe, as Michael Strain said earlier in the program, the fact that people are paid to stay home means that I don't want to get a job. I can hang out at home, what seems a lot better. And so I don't think we know the answer to what happened, but it was a shocking number. And we just have to pay attention to the fact that this could go sideways in a million ways because we're doing something really risky.
Jonathan, do you see that this makes some sort of statement about what President Biden's doing?
I don't think so. Not yet. We cannot, you know, grade the entirety of President Biden's fiscal plans based on one unemployment number. We've got to look at the long haul here. And so, you know, the jury is out on that. However, we have to think about, you know, to all the things that David was just talking about in terms of the inflationary concerns and all of that. We have to also talk about the fact that we're also dealing with still with a global pandemic, people being reticent. As much as folks want to get out and restart their lives, there are a lot of people who can't find jobs, are too afraid to get out there for fear of what's going to happen with the pandemic. And also, on top of all of it, even though lots of states are starting to reopen, some more fully, like New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut have announced, but they're still slowly reopening. So I think it's a little too early, Judy and David, to start being gloom and doom over the state of the economy, not just yet.
Well, in connection with all this, you heard Senator Warren. I asked her about her plans to tax the wealthy. She's has a much more, shall we say, ambitious set of proposals even than what President Biden has put out there. David, where do you see any of this going with regard to taxing the wealthiest in order to pay for what he wants to do?
Well, it's pretty popular. And it's also just a fact that wealth is concentrated over the last 30 or 40 years. It's also just a fact that corporations have done extremely well and corporate profits have done pretty well. So if you want to tax things to pay for things, these are probably the least bad things to tax. There is going to be a cost, you know, when you raise the corporate tax rate, and on the margins, companies will flock to a place with a lower corporate tax rate than a higher corporate tax rate. That's probably true on the margins. But it seems to me the Biden administration has chosen the appropriate areas to raise taxes.
And Jonathan, what do you see when you look at taxes and President Biden and what Senator Warren's saying?
Well, one, I agree with David in the last point that he made. But let's also remember, they're still in the middle of negotiations. And even though I think the initial number the president has put out there, wanting to raise the corporate tax rate to 28% from 21%, and before that, under Trump, it was 35%, and he lowered it that much, that the president and the administration have been sending signals all along that they're willing to negotiate willing to negotiate on that piece. As for Senator Warren, of course, she is going to shoot for the moon and the stars as a means of, one, because she believes it, fully, firmly believes it, but also as a way of trying to push the president further, push him to do more than maybe he is constitutionally, he thinks he's constitutionally capable of. But if the American, rescue plan is any indicator, I don't think she's going to have to push too hard to get the president to think imaginatively about how to go about his policy, his plans.
Let's talk about the Republicans, David. A lot going on in that party the last few days, and next week a vote upcoming among House Republicans. It looks like they are going to kick out Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming as the conference chair in the House because she's not only insufficiently loyal to President Trump, she's saying he actively should not be the person the party's following. What does all this say about the Republican Party?
Well, it's still Donald Trump's party. It shows that you have to, more or less, as everyone is pointing out, you sort of have to be a lie to qualify. You have to lie to qualify to be a Republican. And that's the standard that is now being laid down, and Elizabeth Cheney just didn't want to lie. There's also a lot of internal politics here. That what they want from a person in the leadership role is the ability to get them reelected. And so the House members are worried that because she keeps picking on this issue, she's going to be less effective at raising money and getting them reelected. Elise Stefanik, the person who's probably going to replace her, has read the party. She was a Harvard-educated person who worked in the Bush administration, endorsed John Kasich, and sat out the 2016 convention because Donald Trump was going to be the nominee. Ruth Marcus, our friend, has a good column on this. And she's now a roaring Trumper. And so she's read the wins, and that's what this is all about.
In fact, Lee Stefanik just said in an interview, Jonathan, yesterday, that President Trump is the strongest president ever when it comes to standing up for the U.S. Constitution. But what does all this say from your perspective about what Republicans are where they're headed?
That quote you just read from Congresswoman Stefanik just sort of proves what David was just talking about. In order to be in the leadership, but also to be considered a Republican, you have to lie. All of this tells me that the Republican Party has officially lost its way. It is not about values and substantive issues and being a policy counterweight to the Democratic Party. It is all about being loyal to Donald Trump, one. But also, when it comes to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, it's do anything, say anything to ensure, you hope, that you are in good position to retake the House in 2022. Congresswoman Cheney is a conservative. She is a conservative. Elise Stefanik, by comparison, from upstate New York, is a moderate. And when you look at the Club for Growth gives Elise Stefanik a 35% rating. The Heritage Foundation gives Elizabeth Cheney an 80% rating and Elise Stefanik a 48% rating. And if you want to talk about fealty and loyalty to Donald Trump, Congresswoman Cheney voted with Donald Trump 92.9% of the time as compared to Elise Stefanik, who voted with him 77% of the time. And this is data from 538. So it's like the Soul Train scramble board here. It's going to take a while to figure out what the Republican Party is all about, really. But right now, the Republican Party is about Donald Trump, only about Donald Trump, and how Donald Trump feels about everything. And one last point, Judy, I know I'm going on. The number one reason why Congresswoman Cheney is in trouble is because Donald Trump hates her for telling the truth.
Well, David, as both of you are saying, it is not only what Congresswoman Cheney or Congresswoman Stefanik is saying about former President Trump, but it's also her continuing to insist, along with so many other Republicans, that the election, in her words, she said the election fraud was widespread last year. She's spoken out for this recount going on in Maricopa County, Arizona, that's paid for only by Republicans or being sponsored only by Republicans. So, I mean, this says something about future elections as well.
Yeah, in a country with a lot of problems, the Republicans have picked the one area that's not broken to address all their energy on, and that's elections. And so, you know, they all these laws, I doubt they'll have a huge effect. I think studies show that they don't have a big effect on damping down turnout. But it's just given American history, Jonathan and I have talked about it before, it's just a horrific look. And the amount of energy going into it, and the fact that Florida Governor DeSantis did it, announced his the signing of Florida's new election law on Fox. You know, who does a news event on one network? I mean, this it just shows we are in a land of theater. It's not about anything but the symbols of showing Donald Trump is right about the election. There was a lot of fraud. And it's a theatrical gesture, a Potemkin set of laws to just reinforce the Trump narrative.
And Jonathan, as both of you have said, these election laws have a very real effect on what happens going forward in the congressional elections next year, the midterm elections, and of course beyond.
Right. You know, I think a few shows ago I said that these election laws were a solution in search of a problem. And I cannot remember the person who sent me an email, but they wrote me and said, listen, stop saying that because it's not true. Because from the Republican perspective, it is a solution to solve a problem. And the problem from the Republican perspective is too many Democrats voting. And in the end, that's what this is all about. The mail-in voting, the absentee balloting that Democrats pushed hard because of the problems with the Postal Service, because of fears of going out in public because of the pandemic. Democrats who used to not vote by mail and not absentee vote did it in droves in the safest election in American history, as we learn from the federal government. And so all of these laws are about stopping as many Democrats as possible from voting as a means of increasing Republican power and increasing their chances of retaking the House.
Only a little more than a minute left, but I do want to finally quickly ask both of you, David, about this idea of how the insurrection at the Capitol is investigated. I interviewed Speaker Pelosi this week. She said it's not something that should be chosen by the president. It needs to come from Congress. And right now, Republicans and Democrats are at loggerheads.
I'm dubious. I support the idea, I guess, but I'm dubious they can come up with a commission filled with people who have credibility on both sides. When the 9/11 Commission happened, we had people like Lee Hamilton and Governor Keene of New Jersey leading, people who really were part of the establishment center. We don't have as many people like that. And even those who are in the establishment center have less credibility with the polarized wings. And so it looks, I'm much more pessimistic than I would have been after 9/11, that we can put together a commission that we trust.
And Jonathan.
But we have to put together a commission. It must be done. The horror of January 6th, the tipping point that those events put American democracy on, we cannot forget it. We must investigate it. We must find out what really happened, what truly happened, all the things that we don't know about right now. It must be put before the American people so that at a minimum, we can try to not have that happen again.
Well, I know we are going to continue to ask those questions. In the meantime, we thank you both, Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Judy. You too. See you, David.
As we do each Friday evening, we pause now to remember just a few of the hundreds of thousands of Americans who've lost their lives to COVID-19. Daryl Eason was a mainstay of St. Louis radio for decades.
15 minutes after 6 o'clock on a Wednesday.
A friend said it was because of his smooth voice and charisma, and the fact that the 58-year-old gave his very, very best every time he turned on that mic. He also poured himself into charitable causes, his family said. When he died, he had been working with his sons to launch a scholarship to help promising high school student athletes attend college. Peggy Furness Lee's love of music touched many facets of her life. The 71-year-old from Utah had made her living as a piano teacher, volunteered as an organist at church, and made sure to pass on her piano skills to her 8 children. She made every occasion a family celebration, her daughter said, Whether it meant getting Halloween and Valentine's gifts for her 33 grandchildren and sole great-grandchild, or baking special cookies to mark the 2017 solar eclipse. While family and colleagues described Duran Hill as kind and shy, he was still a linchpin at the Decatur, Alabama restaurant where he worked. The 41-year-old had been a chef there since its early days, and he prided himself on his baking. But his cousin said he also aspired to start his own business or return to school to go into the medical field instead. Duran was well known at his church as well. He especially appreciated singing in his church's gospel choir. His cousin added, it was the sort of music he enjoyed most. Heidi Brevet lived in the moment, her sister told us. The 61-year-old relished traveling with family and friends, which included a visit to Antarctica. But the trips that Heidi enjoyed most were the ones where she could relax and enjoy the banter with those around her. An avid sports fan, she could often be seen in the green and gold colors of her hometown baseball team, the Oakland Athletics. And she made a career out of working at nonprofits, her sister said, because she cared more about giving back to the community than anything else. Mary Barber lived in Pottstown, Pennsylvania for most of her life, and she spent so much of her career in its service. One of her most vivid memories was of attending the 1963 March on Washington. After some time in local government herself, Mary became director of a community center before moving on to a job as a teacher's assistant. Her daughter told us that the 79-year-old cancer survivor and church leader was especially motivated to help the children of her community. As always, we are so grateful to the families who shared these stories with us. Our hearts go out to each and every one of you. And we want to note that Mary Barber, whom you just heard about, was an aunt of one of our colleagues right here at WETA, where the NewsHour is produced. It's a reminder again that this pandemic has touched so many lives over the last year, even those close to us here. It was 60 years ago this Sunday, May 9th, 1961, when President John F. Kennedy's head of the Federal Communications Commission, Newton Minow, gave his first major speech, declaring America's television programming a vast wasteland. Minow was addressing what he saw as the missed opportunities of what television could offer. There were only three networks then, all commercial. Minow's phrase became entrenched in American culture, and it helped lead to the genesis of PBS. The television landscape has changed dramatically since then. Newt Minow joins me now to reflect on that legacy, and he is joined by two of his three remarkable daughters. They are Martha Minow and Mary Minow, and we say hello to them at the same time. It was 1961. You were the 35-year-old precocious head of the Federal Communications Commission. Television was exploding in popularity with Americans, but something you saw bothered you.
What bothered me was that we were wasting this extraordinary technology. I was particularly concerned about children. Children were spending more time with television than they were in school. And they were learning that too often that the solution to a problem was a smack in the head or shot with a gun. And I was very concerned that children in particular. And also I was very concerned with the lack of what we then called educational television, now called public television. And I was determined to do something about it, and so was President Kennedy.
And what was the reaction from the commercial network bosses when you made that speech?
Well, the founder of Gilligan's Island was so irritated with me and with what I'd said that he named the sinking boat in Gilligan's Island the SS Minow, which actually, I think many broadcasters realized for the first time that their obligation under the law was to serve the public interest, not the private interest.
And we know, Newt Minow, at the time you went on to make sure that there was a public television. Originally, it was educational television. In fact, you were involved in the launch of this station, WETA, where we broadcast the news hour. As you reflect on it, what changes began to happen at that time?
I had the privilege, Judy, of giving the first license for WETA, personally giving it to Mrs. Elizabeth Campbell on the same day I gave that speech. And what I envisioned, my dream has been fulfilled. When I see the programs like the News Hour, when I see what Ken Burns has created, when I see Sesame Street, I say, this is what I hoped would happen, and we more than fulfilled my dream.
And as you cast your eye across television broadly, what do you see today?
Well, what we were trying to do was to enlarge choice for the viewer, and we certainly did that. There's plenty of choice today. What I'm disappointed about is that in the course of that, we seem to, too often, particularly in the news world, is confuse facts with opinion. And we're no longer agree on what is a fact. And when that's the situation, which it is today, I think we're in a very dangerous, scary period. Remember what Pat Moynihan, my friend who later became a senator, said. He said, this is a free country. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. And now we have people who think they can make up their own facts.
If you could wave a magic wand, what would you like to see change about what television offers today?
I'd like to see more PBS news hours. I'd like to see more Sesame Streets. I'd like to see more Ken Burns. I'd like to see the opportunity for people. There's a favorite quote I have almost memorized, but I'd like to read it to you. But E.B. White said what he hoped television would be. Non-commercial television should address itself to the idea of excellence, not the idea of acceptability. Television should be providing the visual counterpart of the literary essay, should arouse our dreams, should satisfy our hunger for beauty, should take us on journeys, should enable us to participate in events, should present great dramas and music, explore the sea and the sky and the woods and the hills. It should restate and clarify the social dilemma and the political pickle. Once in a while it does, and you get a quick glimpse of its potential. That's what we were dreaming about when we created public television.
And when you made that speech that we all remember, you said that it's all about what should be in the public interest. Newt Minow, thank you very much. I think the country is grateful to you for what you did 60 years ago and ever since. Thank you.
Judy, we just bless you and hope you keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you on behalf of all of us. Such a thrill to be able to talk to Newt Minow, and congratulations on the 60th anniversary of that speech. And we would ask all of you to stay with PBS tonight. You will not want to miss Yamiche Alcindor in her debut as the new moderator of Washington Week. You can make it a weekly ritual as Yamiche and her guests bring insight into the politics of our times. And that's the News Hour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS News Hour, have a good weekend. Thank you. Please stay safe and good night.